Jamie and John answer your questions about cars, trucks, SUVs, hybrids, and electric vehicles. Summertime can be the best and the worst time to go car shopping. It can also be the best and the worst time to go for a road trip. Confused? I'm Keith Shortall, and today we'll do our best to address the confusion that can follow all things automotive. What's the difference between a hybrid and an electric vehicle? When is an SUV really just a glorified station wagon? And when might the U.S. abandon its love of good old internal combustion engines for an all-electric drivetrain? For answers to all these questions and more, we have our two favorite auto experts. Jamie Page Deaton is the automotive editor for U.S. News, and John Paul is a master mechanic, spokesperson for AAA of New England, and the president of the New England Motor Press. Main calling is next. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. In recent weeks, more and more car companies have announced plans to release all-electric vehicles. GM plans to have 20 electric vehicles on the market by 2023. BMW plans to have 12 electric cars by 2025. And Toyota continues to add to its already significant electric car options. However, these gas alternative cars aren't the only auto innovations making the news lately. Fiat Chrysler announced plans to source self-driving cars from a California startup, and a German company is working to increase auto safety with airbags that deploy from the side exterior of the car. Our two favorite auto experts return today to catch us up on all the latest news. Jamie Page Deaton is the automotive editor for U.S. News and World Report, and John Paul is a master mechanic and spokesperson for AAA New England. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about the latest auto news or about a car you're thinking about purchasing? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Jamie and John, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
So we'll get to some of those headlines and some other listener questions, a whole list of things we can talk about today. But by tradition, we always like to ask you what you're test driving, because in your positions, you get to test drive cars, and it's always interesting and fun. Jamie, we'll start with you. What are you driving these days?
Well, I actually have two test cars this week. One is the Jeep Gladiator Overland, and it is basically a Jeep Wrangler that's also a pickup truck. And I gotta say, I absolutely love it because it's both a convertible and a pickup truck. It makes me miss when I lived in New Hampshire and had to take my trash to the dump every weekend, because it's just the perfect trash truck, because you can drive with the top down, you're not going to be dealing with the smell, and then, you know, once you drop your trash off, you've got a great little runabout for, you know, taking advantage of the summer, and then, you know, when winter comes, it's a Jeep, so it's going to be just fine when the roads are bad. And then the other one that I have this week is the Mazda Miata, which is just, you know, I mean, it's a classic sports car. And it's really simple and elegant and old-fashioned in that it feels like a car instead of an electronic couch that you drive, which is how a lot of sports cars feel lately. And, you know, it's just a great little drop top and super affordable for what you get in terms of, you know, the fun quotient. So both of those have me really just loving summer at the moment, since I can take the top off of both of them and just really enjoy the nice weather.
Sure. What are the general price tags on both? Do you know?
So, you know, the Gladiator can get super expensive. The one that I have is about $40,000. And then the Miata that I have is $33,000. And both of those come with about everything, I think, that you'd want. So the Jeep is the Overland trim. And it's got leather seats. It's got Apple CarPlay. It's got, you know, navigation, heated seats, heated steering wheel. It's got, you know, four-wheel drive, not the very best possible, you know, off-roading package that you can get with a Jeep, but it's got enough for, you know, 99.9% of the population. I think if you're going farther off-road than this Jeep can handle, you know, there's other issues you maybe need to face. I mean, for the Miata, I mean, it's $33,000, which granted is, you know, a little bit expensive for just a little two-seat roadster. I mean, when you consider, you know, what you could also get, you know, if you were shopping sedans or crossovers for $33,000, but none of those are going to be as fun. So you're really trading, you know, practicality for a whole lot of a good time. And for me, you know, $33,000 for a great little sports car to me is totally worth it. Although I've got to say, to save a little bit of money, I would probably look at a used Miata just to save there.
Well, both sound fun. And I love the name Gladiator. It's just, you know, it's a very Saturday afternoon movie-esque. Yeah. John Paul, I don't know if your headphones are working and heard, but Jamie's driving a Jeep Gladiator and a Mazda Miata.
Well, that's kind of two completely different vehicles. And I had the opportunity to drive two completely different vehicles recently, too. The all-electric Kia Niro. So completely electric, no gasoline engine, great range, about a 250-mile range. Pretty good performance, not as peppy as, say, maybe a Tesla Model 3. But from 0 to 30, a little sluggish. From 30 to 65, plenty of performance, plenty of power. We have a charging station at work. I could completely recharge it in the time that I would sit at work. But I only used, I commute a pretty long distance. I commute about 50 miles each way to work. Fully charged it up in a couple hours, so it was fully back to the 250-mile range. Really was one of my first experiences in a long-distance or long-range electric car. I was a pretty early adopter of electric cars. I had an electric car years and years ago when, frankly, it was horrible. It was a Renault LeCar. So it started off with a bad car, started off with a bad French car, and then a company in Massachusetts converted it to electricity. And it was very, very slow, and it didn't have a good range, and it took forever to recharge. And this Kia was really quite nice, and it was kind of funny. I picked it up about 50 miles from home, and I didn't realize it was fully electric. And I got in it, and I'm like, oh, I hope I can make it home. And then I looked down at the range, and it had a couple hundred miles left on it. So I said, this is going to be great. And I drove it, and it was a fantastic car, kind of in a little on the, like, all-electric cars, a little on the pricey side, mid-40s or so. But still, really, really kind of a good car that really kind of, if you looked at electric cars and you said, you know, I drive X amount of miles, it would satisfy, even though I commute a long distance, it would satisfy most of my driving needs, I think. So it really, really looked okay. And last week, I belong to a group called the New England Motor Press Association. And periodically, we have different car companies come and kind of show off their wares. First time I ever drove the Jeep Gladiator, for instance, was when Jeep came to show it off. Last week, we had Rolls-Royce come to town. So they brought their new Cullinan, which is their SUV. So Rolls-Royce built an SUV, which seems strange in itself. And then they also brought their Phantom, which is their kind of top-of-the-line big car. And something about being in a car that costs more than any house I will ever own in my entire life, and certainly if I ever did park it in my driveway, it would triple the price of my house. So it had some interesting options. The radio in the Cullinan, which is actually named after the largest diamond ever mine, the radio was, and I don't know what it came with for a radio, so you have to think the Rolls-Royce came with a pretty good radio to start off with. The upgraded radio was $10,000. And then the rear center console, so if you're sitting in the back, and I assume the kids are sitting in the back, and it had a lot of little features. With the center console was $15,000. So the radio and the center console together cost more than any new car that I've ever purchased. And so it is a Rolls-Royce. Yeah, right. And it had some really they were talking about the leather interior. And they only get the leather from cows that graze only at very high altitude, so they don't get stung by bees and mosquitoes, and the leather's perfect. And the people who stitch the interiors, it's one person who stitches the entire car because they don't want the technique to change somewhere along the line. Somebody puts the stitch a little closer together than the person that started it. The convertible version has this wooden cover that kind of goes, folds down when the convertible top goes down. And from what I understand, they source their wood from someplace in Africa. And they used to float it up a river, but it stained the wood. So they hired people with elephants to carry the wood to wherever its ultimate destination was so they could turn it into this wooden interior piece. And you just, when you kind of get in the car and go, it's a very nice car. It's probably, the Phantom was probably the nicest riding, smoothest. It just absolutely makes potholes disappear. You don't even notice. It's such a smooth ride. But you go, $650,000. You know, it's, right. And you go, what makes this? And then you start to hear about each piece of wooden interior, the is matched. So the grain matches throughout the whole car. And it's amazing how the cars are put together. So it's, I think I drove up in the electric Kia. And then drove that for 45 minutes, and it was sort of interesting.
Continuing on with the electric cars, this thing is happening, Jamie, in all the companies that we mentioned at the top. Even Porsche, I understand, is coming out is going electric. What is driving this? No pun intended. Is it consumer demand worldwide, or environmental regulations worldwide, or other things?
I mean, it's more environmental regulations worldwide than consumer demand, because, I mean, at least within the U.S. market, like, there is, you know, if you do the kitchen table math on an EV, given the current gas prices, it just doesn't work out for most people. And the demand just isn't there. I mean, you still look at just electrified vehicle sales, which includes pure EVs, but also includes things like gas electric hybrids. And they're less than 2% of the U.S. new car market. Now, in other countries, there is more demand. I mean, you have countries, you know, like Norway, which are trying to, you know, get rid of all internal combustion cars. I think by 2030 is the date that they've set for that. So there is more demand from other countries, some of which is consumer-led, some of which is government-led. But really, what automakers are realizing is, you know, these things take a long time to develop. This is going to be a long time before electric vehicles are totally mainstream because, again, you know, you have models like the Kia Niro that John's been driving, which are relatively affordable, or like the Hyundai Kona EV, which are relatively affordable. But what needs to happen for us to get to where EVs really do make sense for people is a lot more development on the vehicle side to bring down costs. And then there needs to be a lot more infrastructure, and automakers and battery companies really need to figure out charging time, because that's a huge issue now. If you have an EV, you know, you can drive up to even a fast charging station and it'll take 20 minutes to get a full charge, which, you know, if you're on a road trip, that gives you time to stop, stretch your legs, get a cup of coffee. But if there are three people ahead of you in line, all of a sudden you've added an hour to your trip, as opposed to gas, which, you know, 5 minutes you're on the road. So there are still a number of hurdles, but automakers are realizing, you know, this is something that governments are demanding, and this is something to another extent that investors are starting to demand, because they're a lot more future facing, and automakers in general have become more future facing. Something that's, you know, a leftover from the Great Recession, as automakers realize, okay, we can't just plan for today, we've got to really look down the road. But then the other part of it too is this actually, you know, the growth of EVs has a lot to do with autonomous technology, because it is much easier to develop autonomous technology or advanced driver assistant features for an electric car than it is for a gas-powered car. The way that I kind of think about it is, it's a lot easier, you know, to hook your computer to a digital clock than it is to hook it to a grandfather clock, because, you know, the systems are speaking the same language. So as there's more of a push towards these advanced driver assistance features or autonomous features, you really need to have an electric powertrain to make that more possible. But, you know, at this point, it's not really about what the consumers want. This is about government regulation and looking at, you know, what automakers can do to bring down, you know, their carbon footprint and to meet the various standards there. But at the same time, consumer demand is still driving the call for big, you know, gasoline powered, you know, powerful SUVs. I mean, if you look at, say, Jaguar Land Rover as a brand, yes, they have the Jaguar I-Pace, which is a great electric car, but their big sellers are massive Land Rover SUVs that really don't get very good gas mileage at all, but that's what's driving the brand and, you know, providing the kind of profits that it takes to develop something like the I-Pace.
And don't we, John, isn't there a pretty good inventory of combustion engine cars in the world or the United States that we have to get through before we move along?
Well, there certainly is. And I mean, the average car on the road today is almost 12 years old when you compare cars and when you combine cars and trucks together. So for us to turn into an electric car culture and economy, it is going to take a long time for that to happen. And then there becomes both the battery technology and the supplies that go into building the latest lithium-ion batteries or whatever the next battery is going to be. And then the third part of that is recharging them. And like Jamie pointed out, you know, even fast charging, you can recharge pretty quickly, 20 minutes to 30 minutes, depending on the car. But my concern has always been, how is the electrical grid going to be able to handle recharging a lot of cars? And people say, well, smart charging times, they can charge off peak and so forth. But as we approach summer, there will be some time across the country there where we'll see brownouts, where there's just not enough electricity to run people's air conditioners. And it seems to happen in the Midwest, and it happens in California. And my concern is, as I buy an electric car, and you go, and you're my neighbor down the street, and you go, that's a pretty good idea, I'm going to buy one. And then Jamie's my neighbor around the corner, and she buys one. And then we all plug in together, and all of a sudden the lights dim. You know, we have to worry about what's going to happen with the infrastructure and make sure that there's enough electricity available to do this. And I know as we're looking at additional electric sources and renewable and all that, it all has to be part of that puzzle to make it all work. Like I said, I was an early adopter of electric cars. I had an electric car for a couple of years. I liked it. Whenever I drive an electric car, I enjoy it. On the other hand, I also like driving a 700-horsepower crazy car, too. And so I was talking to someone just the other day, and they were talking about the perfect car for Father's Day, and it was a Mercedes station wagon AMG version that produced 650 horsepower and went from 0 to 60 in 3.5 seconds. And I said, does anyone really need that? And both of us said, no one ever needs it. But we're kind of glad they built it, though, just because, it's a kind of a fun thing. It's certainly not every day. And an electric car is certainly, has its potential, as do hybrids and some other alternative fuels.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your questions for Jamie and John. 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. It's Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. And Jane and Frank Bragg of Bangor, proud to support the independent journalism and new voices of Maine Public News.
Hey, it's David Green here. The last car I owned was a navy blue Volkswagen Jetta. One night when I was driving home from a trip, I really needed to go to the bathroom, and I couldn't find a parking space. Finally, I found a space about a mile and a half from my house. I was angry at Washington, D.C., and frankly, angry at my car. It wasn't really the car's fault, but at that moment, I decided I was going car-free, and I've never had to hold it in since. No matter what your reason is for getting rid of your car, turn it into the programs you love.
Visit mainpublic.org and click on support. The Maine Public News Tell Me More tour is underway as Maine Public News travels the state to hear directly from you and learn what you feel are the most important issues in your community and how Maine Public News can best serve you and keep you informed. We're headed next to Portland this evening, starting at 5:30 at the Rising Tide Brewing Company at 103 Fox Street in Portland. News director Mark Simpson with our news staff, including Erwin Gratz and Willis Arnold, are among those who will be there. For more information about the Tell Me More tour visits, please visit mainpublic.org and click on events or the banner ad.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, the latest in auto news. My guests are two car experts, John Paul, a master mechanic and spokesperson for AAA, and Jamie Page Deaton, automotive editor for U.S. News and World Report. As always, we invite you to join the conversation. The number, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the issue of safety developments, John, in cars, it's interesting that headlights seem to be coming up. I've seen articles saying that brighter, safer headlights are coming. The question is when. And we have a note from Donna here who says, "Hi, I have a 2016 RAV4. I went back immediately to the dealership After the first time I drove it at night, I can't see up ahead without the high beams on. As a result, I can't see at night when there's a bit of fog. The dealership said they're aware of nothing that can be, there's nothing that can be done. I have seen this car on an NTSB list of vehicles with inadequate headlights. What's going on with, or is there something going on with headlights?
It's interesting. Back in the turn of the last century, you know, headlights were essentially candles in front of a reflector. They were terrible. And then they became better and better. And in the 60s, they were just regular steel beams, and they worked okay. Then they come out with halogen headlights, which were better. And then we've come out with some new technology and LEDs and xenon headlights that were brighter and did a much better job. But still, the majority of cars on the road, when you have the low beam lights on, really don't light the road if you're going more than, say, 45 or 50 miles an hour. So it's really up to the driver at that point to flip their high beams on so they can actually see where they're going. And some of it's design. I mean, you look at cars today, and they're essentially designed in a wind tunnel. That's why all cars sort of look alike, because of aerodynamics. And as they make the headlights space smaller, you end up with kind of that type of thing going on where you get a little bit less light. So there are cars with better headlights. There are cars with worse headlights. But really what it comes down to, as drivers, we have to try to light the road the best we can and turn our high beams on where we may have not been used to doing that so much before. It's important that we are. And again, when you look at it, it's actually math. And it's sort of, you know, your headlights will light X amount of feet ahead. And if you're traveling at 45 miles an hour, you're going to only light that distance. And as you get going 50 or 55, especially on some of these back roads where you can get moving along, you need to turn your high beams on. And, of course, you know, you need to dim them when there's oncoming traffic or you pull up behind someone. So some of it is headlights. And the other problem is we're hampered by a law for headlights that was created back in the 70s. It was refined in the 80s. But it's keeping us from getting some of the better headlights that have developed around the world. Audi makes a fantastic headlight system that doesn't really have high and low beams. It just says light. And when it senses oncoming traffic, it dims a portion of it. So there's no glare to the other drivers, but there's a super amount of light on the road, and it's only there when you need to. It's really good. Mercedes has something similar. I don't think it's quite as good as the Audi. But it's prohibited from being sold here and because of the technology.
All right, well, I'm going to check our connection to Jamie. Jamie, can you hear us? I'm guessing she cannot hear us. All right, let's go to Ryan in Rochester, New Hampshire. Hi, Ryan. Welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yep, so I have been driving a Toyota Corolla for the better part of 25 years, different Corollas. I think I'm on my fifth or sixth one. I love the reliability, love the Toyota brand. Problem is I am incredibly bored with driving, you know, pretty much the same car for the last 25 years. What would you recommend, or what should I be looking at, same price range, that I'm going to experience about the same amount of reliability?
Well, there is about 250 other choices of cars on the road, so you have plenty of opportunity. I would probably, you know, I might look at something from Mazda. Mazda makes some great cars now. They're fun to drive. They're peppy to drive. They're fun. Something like Subaru, all-wheel drive. You could even step up a little to a WRX, so a little bit high-performance version that still gets good gas mileage. There are a lot of choices out there. Do you like you've had the Corolla for 25 years, so you sort of like the size, although it's kind of interesting. 25 years ago, your Corolla was a kind of a subcompact car that's kind of almost turned midsize in its later years. But it is, if you had to describe the Corolla as maybe ice cream, it would be a little bit on the vanilla side, though.
Ryan, is that useful?
Yeah, that's very useful. I've had them all the way back, exactly what you're saying, to the FX16. So, yeah, I'm going to start looking at Mazda. That's a good tip.
The Mazdas are really fun to drive. I drove the new Mazda 3 recently, which is, you know, not quite an SUV, not quite a sedan. Really fun to drive, and you can get it with all-wheel drive now, which makes it a killer car. They did a really nice job with it.
All right, Ryan, best of luck. We'll go now to Jeannie in Saco. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi.
Hi, Jeannie. Yeah, go ahead.
Thanks. I'm calling in reference to your conversation about electric cars. So we are an all-electric car household, and I wanted to say, you know, it's not as if we're making this decision between electric and gas cars in a vacuum. There is a climate crisis going on right now. So, and I have found that in addition to it being a joy to drive electric cars, and we first bought a Leaf, a used Leaf. It was well under $10,000, and it's great. And then we bought a Bolt, which has a longer range, so we can get pretty much anywhere we need to go. But they're also so much cheaper to maintain. They just don't have all the engine parts. And so our garage bill has gone down by a lot. So I want to encourage Ryan or anybody else to really look into electric cars.
I think we have Jamie back, but John, I'll let you respond to the maintenance question.
No, electric cars are great. You rarely wear out brakes. Tires you're going to wear out just like everything else. But, yeah, no oil changes. Depending on the car, there is sometimes a coolant change because the batteries use a advanced cooling system to help keep them going. The Leaf is actually a really good value as a used car right now because they came out with the new longer range Leaf that has about 150 mile range, and it kind of killed some of the resale on the other ones. So the average person drives about 15 miles a day. So even with a Leaf with a 90 to 110 mile range, the Leaf can be a really good alternative for somebody. And, you know, for people that don't think electric cars have performance, they absolutely do. So going electric for a lot of reasons can really work for people. And your Bolt, for instance, with its 230 plus mile range, is a great car. You just, you know, people need to rationalize the cost of the car versus kind of, you know, some people look at size, quality relationship sort of thing, and you get a small car, but you get a small car that's very efficient and can be really fun to drive. So yeah, good choice and good, you know, good going all electric. It's a great thing to do.
I know everyone's probably not going to buy a Tesla, but I did ride in a Tesla not that long ago, and the owner demonstrated the acceleration on the Tesla, which I was not prepared for, and it was actually uncomfortable.
Teslas are wicked fast is the best way to describe them. And it's sort of interesting. When you get the Tesla with the great big battery, the 100D system, I saw an acceleration test, and it was the Tesla Model X, so they're sort of SUV, towing a trailer with a Dodge Hellcat on the back of it, racing a 700-horsepower Dodge Hellcat, and it beat it, towing the trailer. So that's how fast they are. They have crazy acceleration. They're also $100,000 cars, and, you know, they're a premium car, and you got to pay for it. But, yeah, if you don't think electric cars are fast, you haven't been in one.
Right. Let's see. Let's go to Bob in Winslow. Hi, Bob.
Hi. The most popular car in the country is the Camry, and it has been for several years. This is a $25,000 car. Are we talking these new electric cars in that range, or are we talking about folks who have to have a great deal more money than that?
Yeah, Jamie, now that you're back with us, I will I'll let you field that one.
Thanks. So first, the Camry is not technically the most popular car in the U.S. It is the most popular car in the U.S. The most popular vehicle in the U.S. is the Ford F-150. So that should tell you something about the market that we're dealing with and the way that American consumers are voting with their wallets. Now, the Camry runs in price, you know, it starts at about $25,000, but it goes up to, you know, over $35,000. And so it's a top-of-the-line Camry that's going to line up in terms of price with some of the newer electric cars on the market. And to the earlier caller's point about, you know, the lower maintenance costs, like that is absolutely true with an electric vehicle. But for a lot of people, it's the upfront costs that are going to, you know, get in the way of them taking on an EV, which is really a shame. And if you look at some of the data too, you know, as the government tax credits towards EVs, a lot of those are running out now. But if you look at the actual income level of the people who took advantage of those tax credits, these are people who tend to make much more money than the typical, American. And so what those tax credits did, you know, the goal of them was to get people to adopt EVs and to make them a little bit more widespread. But, you know, there's definitely some analysis that suggests that the result of it was they subsidized rich people getting into luxury cars like Teslas, as opposed to helping some people, you know, get into a more affordable electric car like a Leaf or like a Bolt. And so, you know, if you're willing to spend like around 37, then yes, you'll be getting into an electric car. But if you have less to spend than that, then you might be looking at a used one, or, you know, a gasoline powered car really is your best option. But the other side of it too is if you look at new car sales, just in general, new car sales are trending downward, and it's largely due to the fact that new car prices are trending upward. The average price of a new car is now around $37,000. Most people cannot afford that. And so you see a lot of growth in the used car market, where the average price is just around $20,000. And what that means, though, is in the used car market, because the EVs haven't trickled down over there yet, if that's where you're shopping, and it is where the majority of Americans are shopping, there are fewer EV options, which helps explain, too, why there are fewer people adopting them.
So is there a sort of a magic price point where a new electric car would sort of take off in America?
You know, a lot of people thought if they could get it sub 35 that it would, or sub 30. But I think, you know, just from what I've seen, if you can get it around that point at about $30,000, and I think the other side of it is, and have it be a good car. And that is what, you know, I had very high hopes, you know, for the Bolt. But a lot of people were resistant to buying, and a lot of market research bears this out, people were resistant to buying an electric car from Chevrolet because Chevrolet is known for their big SUVs and their big trucks. And then the other side of it, though, is just consumer preference. Consumer preference is really driving a lot of this, and consumers right now are really going for large trucks and SUVs. And you see that, you know, in the new market, you see it in the used market. Now, what might change that has a little bit less to do with price and more about just generational shifts. You know, Cox Automotive, which is a conglomerate of, you know, automotive sites like Kelley Blue Book and Auto Trader, they've done a lot of research that shows that Generation Z and the younger millennials, they don't want the large SUVs that their parents have been driving. They are looking at, you know, sedans and smaller cars, which would make them more open to the kind of electric cars that are on the market right now. Now, what's unclear from that research is if that preference is driven because they truly want those smaller cars and sedans, or because they can't afford the larger SUVs and trucks that baby boomers have been buying. So that'll just be, I think, we'll see a little bit more of a trend towards EVs because you have a younger generation coming up that tends to be a little bit more concerned about, you know, climate change, that tends to not want the large SUVs or not need the large SUVs, or in some cases can't afford the large SUVs. And then it's those smaller cars, and including some of the smaller EVs like the Niro or the Kona or the Bolt, that will have a lot more appeal. But like right now, for a lot of American buyers, you know, they just want a big SUV, and there aren't a lot of affordable big electric SUVs out there.
All right, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments for Jamie and John. The number, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Husson University. Committed to strengthening Maine's future by preparing the business, health, and communication professionals of tomorrow. Husson.edu. And Maine Farmland Trust, celebrating farm viability at Ripley Farm in Dover Foxcroft, June 27th. MaineFarmlandTrust.org. On the next Speaking in Maine, whither Syria and where is it taking us?
I know maybe hundreds of Syrians personally who staked their lives on the proposition that if they recorded what was happening to them, the beatings, the massacres, something would happen to stop this.
Anne Bernard is a New York Times journalist. She spoke at the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations in Northport about current events in Syria. That's coming up on Speaking in Maine, Tuesday afternoon at 2, here on Maine Public Radio. Thinking about donating your used vehicle to Maine Public? Doing so from now through the end of June is a good time. Not only will it be towed away for free and you could get a possible tax credit, but also our friends at Lee Auto Malls will provide a $500 Lee certificate for use towards the purchase of any new or used vehicle at any Lee Auto Malls location around the state. For complete information, please visit mainpublic.org and click on the banner or click on the events dropdown. Thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, what's happening in the auto world? Joining me are two car experts, John Paul, a master mechanic and spokesperson for AAA, and Jamie Page Deaton, automotive editor for U.S. News and World Report. Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number, 1-800-399-3566. John, you're president of the one of your hats is president of the New England Motor Press Association, and you had your sort of an event recently, including an awards.
Right. The New England Motor Press Association's about 25 years old now, and I will say it wasn't the same event without Jamie there since she's moved to Iowa, but it's one of those things that we've combined. We've had awards for cars over the years, but about 7 or 8 years ago, we also combined it. We do it at MIT in Cambridge, and we do a technology program as well. We started off with autonomous vehicles about 8 years ago, and we've had a lot of different subjects, whether it was kind of lighter, faster, stronger. Let's try to make cars that will be strong but be light, be more fuel efficient, all kinds of different things. Last year, we brought up autonomous vehicles again, and we wanted to see where we were in that circle. This year, we really wanted to talk about the driver experience. What happens when you get inside a car? Now, some of our panelists really focused on what's going to happen in the future with autonomous vehicles, and are you going to get in a car where you just don't do anything? Some others looked at it a little bit differently. We also looked at the technology that's going to take place. Interesting, Hyundai, for instance, sees a time in the real near future that you won't have a key to your car at all. You won't have a key fob. Your phone will be your key. So you'll walk up to your car. You'll hold your phone up against the car. It'll do something. It'll get in, and you won't have a fob. My question was, my phone goes dead about once a week. What's going to happen? Yeah. They didn't have a really good answer for that. Looking at some of those, the technology that goes into that. So we looked at it, and then, of course, there's the technology that goes into sort of autonomous vehicles, and is it going to be 5G, which is the new cell phone system that's coming out or might even be out very limited right now, or is it something called DSRC, digital short-range communications? Mm-hmm. That was going to be set aside. The government decided, well, let's leave it. Let's open it up to everything. So there's this whole conflict of, if you're old enough, beta versus VHS kind of argument thing going on. So real interesting, but really it's, you kind of get an idea of what the future is and, you know, what the experience is. Then we also give out awards, and this year, we, as in years past, we separated the awards out, best car, best truck, to handle New England. So we have auto writers from all around New England and in some parts around the country who we get together and we vote and we see what we like best. In the truck category, it was the Ram 1500, fantastic truck. It works like a truck. It rides like a car. They did a really, really nice job with it. And in the sedan category, the new Genesis, so sort of the premium line of Hyundai, and it's a fantastic car, and they did a really, really nice job with it.
All right, great. Let's go to Sarah in Dresden. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. So this is really timely for me. So my husband's car just died today. He drives a 2010 Subaru Outback, and he has an hour and 45 minute commute one way. So what we're looking for is a car that's dependable, that will last a really, really long time, but that's also fuel efficient.
All right, Jamie.
Well, I'm so like happy for you because there is sometimes a silver lining when your car dies because yay, you get to buy a new one. But also, the 2010 Outback dying, like that's a little bit disappointing because that's only 9 years that you got out of it. But then again, with an hour and a half to an hour and 45 minute commute, I imagine that it had a fair number of miles at it as well. If you want to stick with Subaru, the Subaru Crosstrek is a great car, gets pretty good gas mileage, and is, you know, great, again, you know, for New England winters. If you're willing to give up stuff like all-wheel drive, and then you can go for something like a sedan, like a Camry or an Accord, which both get excellent gas mileage, are very comfortable for long commutes. But honestly, too, I think you would do yourself a disservice if you're not looking at something like a smaller crossover like the Honda HR-V, or even if you wanted something about the same size as the Outback, the Honda CR-V, or the Toyota RAV4. Both of those are incredibly dependable. You'll see people racking up just hundreds of thousands of miles on them. Gas mileage is good for the class, and both are, you know, relatively affordable and should last you, you know, over many comfortable long commutes.
I have an hour and a half commute many times, and I have a RAV4, so that's good advice, Jamie. You're correct. Sarah, best of luck. Let's go to Charles in Freeport. Hi, Charles.
Hi there. I want to talk about the electric vehicles. You were talking about earlier how people have cars that are about 12 years or so. I feel like that's a kind of a long time to have a car. And do you think that people or companies should be putting out new, more electric vehicles now to kind of stimulate those getting out there? Or do you think they should wait until they're a little bit better?
I think that, Jamie, was that your point? Or was it you, John? I forgot.
I think it was John.
Oh, John, do you want to respond?
Well, I mean, the idea that the average car on the road is getting to be about 12 years old, and it's going to take a while for the fleet to turn over. And it's a little bit of the chicken or egg thing. It has to be something consumers want. And like Jamie pointed out, consumers right now want trucks and SUVs. And whoever figures out what the next thing is, and I don't know what that is. You know, when families in the 60s had station wagons, and they switched to minivans, and then they switched to SUVs. So whoever figures out what the next thing is, and whether it is really the Gen Z and the millennials that want a small, practical, you know, hatchback sort of thing. I don't. Whoever figures that out will do fantastically well. But you can't go, and this has happened in the past. Manufacturers have said, we're going to build these and people will come. And if they don't come, they end up with a whole bunch of cars that nobody really wants. So for the manufacturers to build a lot of electric cars and put them on the lots and people walk right by them and go to the SUV, unless it becomes somehow affordable, and like Jamie pointed out, when you're looking at the average transaction price in the mid to high 30s, that's a lot of money. The last new car I bought was last year, and I thought spending $23,000 was too much. So, but I'm legendarily cheap. So,
just to add in on that, though, I mean, the cost factor, you've got to ask yourself, are people keeping these cars for 12 years because they want to? And because they're sitting there thinking, well, there's nothing better than this, you know, 12-year-old Suzuki Spirit that I'm driving. No, it's they're sitting there and thinking, you know, I'm sure I'd like a new car, but I probably can't afford one. And if you look at kind of what's going on with auto loans now, where the average auto loan is, you know, creeping up to 70 months, so over 5 years for a car loan, I mean, it's really just kind of letting, you know, it's pointing to demand just isn't there, either because that people, you know, like the cars they have, but more likely because people cannot afford new cars. I mean, if you follow new car prices and track them against, you know, wage growth, wages have stayed flat. New car prices have spiked up. It's the same. Even used car prices have grown faster than wages have. And then the other side of it, too, is, you know, over the past couple of years, you know, through, I'd say, 2016, you know, we had a lot of pent up demand because in 2008, you know, we had the Great Recession and people stopped buying cars, and we saw the average age of cars on the road really tick up as people hung on to their cars. Well, starting at about 2014 through 2016, all that pent-up demand really got satisfied as new car sales hit higher and higher levels every year. And now we're going down. And so that pent-up demand has been satisfied, and there's not going to be another big push for new car sales until a lot of the new cars that people bought in, you know, 2014 to 2016, until those age out of the fleet. So it could be a little while.
Just a few minutes left. We're going to take as many calls as we can. We'll go to John in Jefferson. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Okay, good, good. I'm somebody with a deep green consciousness, and what worries me is that as the electric cars are phased in, which I appreciate, what about these millions and millions, hundreds of millions of cars? So why not have a way to retrofit existing cars? Suppose you got a five-year-old car, maybe it's got a few problems with the engine, or maybe it doesn't, but how about taking out the internal combustion engine, retrofitting for electric? And then you're on your way with, you know, maybe a $5,000 investment just off the top of my head. That seemed like a much better way to use resources.
Yeah, thank you, John. I'm not sure that's possible, but
it really isn't. And going back to my horrible electric car experience that I had, it really was a conversion. It was a Renault car that they pulled the engines out. And in Massachusetts, there was another company called Solectria that at the time bought Geo Metros, and they pulled the drivetrains out. They donated the drivetrains to something and put electric motors in, and they turned into very expensive cars. So you're looking at $10,000 to $20,000 for batteries and the electric motor, and then all of the parts and pieces that go into it. It just wouldn't be practical. Not saying it can't be done, but it just wouldn't be practical or very cost effective to be able to do it.
On the issue of charging stations, of which there are just not enough, I'm just curious why, you know, gas stations, existing gas stations, don't just add that, like they have air for your tires or something else. So, you know, it would be sort of a conversion that way. Is it too costly up front to do that?
It's not that costly, but I don't think anybody at a gas station wants somebody sitting for 4 hours. So the idea of doing that 20-minute recharge might work. The cost gets more expensive. You have to bring more power to it. To put a typical level two charging station in, which is one that takes, which charges at a reasonable level, but again, a fully discharged battery could take 8 to 10 hours to recharge. Mm-hmm. That can be done for probably $3,000 or $4,000, and less than that, depending on how it's done. But a bunch of years ago, one of the gasoline companies was going to put compressed natural gas pumps. So CNG looked like it was going to be real popular. Ford came out with a CNG car at the time. Honda had one. There was a couple car makers that came out with it, and they said, well, we'll put CNG in. And then gasoline got to be $1.50 a gallon, and nobody wanted a CNG car. And it's a little bit of that. So right now we're seeing municipalities put in the electric charging stations. Some businesses put them in as a way to kind of look green sort of thing at the same time and to satisfy some employees that may work there. But gas stations are all about getting the people in and getting them out, and that you just can't do that quite yet with the charging station infrastructure and the design and kind of the way the system works.
Yeah, Jamie, we only have 30 seconds left. Did you want to add anything about?
The businesses where you see charging stations are where people are going to hang out for at least 20 minutes. So, you know, my grocery store has charging stations. My gym has charging stations. I'm starting to see charging stations at, you know, various malls and shopping plazas. Because I don't know, I don't really want to hang out at a gas station for 20 minutes up to 4 hours while the car charges. But combining it with other errands that people are going to do anyway, or offering it as an amenity, you know, if you're renting office space, or if you are, you know, a condo building or something like that, that makes complete and total sense. And even if you look at kind of new home builders, charging stations are starting to become more common in new home builds as an option that, you know, if you're building a house, just check the box and you'll get your own charging station. And then you really don't have to worry about it that much.
All right. Well, for the record, I like hanging out at gas stations. It's just
so
me.
Do I.
Jamie and John, thank you both again for being here today. Appreciate it.
Pleasure.
All right, thank you.
Jamie Page Deaton is the automotive editor for U.S. News and World Report, and John Paul, a master mechanic and AAA New England spokesperson. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Ella Boyd answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources, by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast tonight again at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.